Kansas City. John Grayson, Rob Ross here with you once again. I'm John, he's Rob. Rob, how goes everything?
Well, my fellow Americans, let me just say this much. I am here today to announce that I am, in fact, running for emperor of this great country of ours, because I'm going to take over and I'm going to give this country what it needs, an enema.
Yeah. Oh, no kidding. And wait till we get to the section where we talk a little bit about politics, because there's somebody else I want to go after today. And he's a guy who represents to me the absolute worst in the political, the overarching political puke that everybody can't stand. And when you hear it come out of somebody who is ostensibly a little bit closer to your own philosophical leanings, it's even harder to take. You'd think it'd be easier because you could give somebody a pass. When somebody whose ideas I like starts spouting that shit, it makes me want to kill him.
Well, I'll tell you what, you've got yours and I've got mine, because I've got a doozy for you. And I'm sure you've heard the stories trickling across the country about how ludicrous things have gotten, especially here in New York. But it sets my teeth on edge, and I mean that in the most serious fashion possible. And I've been basically, you know, frothing at the mouth all week, because having to listen to this, the drivel, the insanity from both the, quote, source itself and the mindless, I don't even know what you want to call these people anymore. The ones who just want to be offended for the sake of arguments.
Yep.
It's been one of those weeks, certainly in the New York area. But the first thing I do want us to talk about, most importantly, is the people of Houston and what they're going through right now. At last look, 17, that is not an exaggeration, 17 feet of water. They've showed a photo on my Facebook feed. I think it was taken from a drone just above the highway signs, and the water is approaching the top of the highway signs itself.
Yeah.
That's how bad it is. A count of 5 dead thus far over this weekend. And let us hope and pray that the storm will just pass very soon and be downgraded, and that will be it.
Yeah, and the fact that the rain came as fast as it did and as hard as it did was predictable, but this gives a real indication as to just how hard it can be when you're dealing with a period of 72 hours to maybe 96 hours out from this thing becoming, well, there's a little tropical depression out there, to holy shit. NOAA put out a video that's a satellite video at 30-second intervals. So you figure that's, what's 30 times 30, 900 times faster as a time-lapse sort of photography as to how this storm developed. And from the top, it looked like a boiling pot on a stove. It was frightening how fast this thing just popped up and became a monster. And it hit as a Category 4. So,
and it was downgraded yesterday.
Right. And yeah.
To a 2.
Yep. And then down to a tropical storm over the last 24 hours. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, for everybody that's there dealing with this, it's how do you recover? How do you recover from that much water in a downtown area the size and scope of Houston, Texas? Not to mention Galveston, not to mention everything from Galveston all the way down the coast to Brownsville. They just got beaten severely by this. And yeah, they'll pop back, but it's going to be a hell of a long time.
Yeah, and the only thing that I can say, especially with the fact that, of course, we made it through Sandy.
Yeah.
Certainly we did, where I am on my, you know, in my little part of Staten Island, because we're on a hill, so we aren't in an evacuation zone, but the devastation can still be seen to this day, and it's an ongoing problem, a lingering headache and heartache for most people, so my heart goes out to everybody down in Texas right now. We're thinking of you. So.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. And there's a couple of other things that we wanted to tackle, one of which, oddly enough, has a connection back to national politics. And maybe we'll get into talking about the pardon of Joe Arpaio in just a little bit. But one of the more sordid affairs that he was involved in was going after the Phoenix New Times, which is the alternative newspaper in Phoenix, Arizona. And they had had a long-standing bout with him. And at one point in the middle of the night, he sent the goon squad over, and this is no exaggeration, to arrest the editor-in-chief and the guy, the general manager of that newspaper. And they didn't know where they were going. It's a terrifying affair, but it was part of the legacy of Joe Arpaio. The connection here is that the same company that owns the Phoenix New Times also owns a paper, Rob, that you're very familiar with, The Village Voice. They had big news this week. What's going on?
It's the end of an era is what it is. It's very sad. It's the end of the printed edition of The Village Voice. And that it came as a shock to me, yes and no. I mean, with the way that print media has been going, it's not surprising that you hear these stories. But when it's something that is a true institution, certainly of a place like New York City for so long, to hear that it's no longer going to be physically printed, that it's only going to be online, is it's jarring, especially because for so many of us, certainly of my age range, my generation, and the ones before me, this was how we got our introduction into life in the city. If you lived in the outer boroughs, you know, this is where you found clubs and shows and bands and music. And, you know, if you were of the punk rock persuasion, as so many of us were, especially in the mid to late 70s, this was your lifeline and your Bible, because this is how you knew about things and learned. You know, it was you had to have the Village Voice, and at the time you had to pay for it, which was fine. It was like, you know, for me it was a dollar investment a week, you know, every Wednesday religiously.
Yeah.
And then a couple of years ago it became free and was, you know, literally available on every street corner. But you know, apart from readership dwindling and the fact that they had a massacre of their best writers a couple of years ago and got rid of most of the big names that had been there since I was a teenager, you knew the writing was really on the wall. And like I said, was it wholly expected? Sure. But it's still jarring to think that there will be no longer a Village Voice to pick up on a Wednesday. So, yeah. You know, fare well to that. It will be missed. I think it leaves yet again another major void in what used to be the most interesting city in the world. I think New York, which is the city that I was born and raised and still live in, is probably one of the most uninteresting flatline places you can think of, because there's absolutely nothing dynamic or exciting about it anymore. It's just like anywhere else USA.
Right.
You know, the fact 42nd Street is a mass of Applebee's and The Gap and H&M. You know, what does that tell you? That's not a tourist trap, because tourists can get them in their own local malls. It's just a sad prefab kind of city that caters to tourists in a way that I'm not even sure I understand anymore, because there's nothing here. The fact that you pay upwards of $25 to go to a museum, to me, that's an aberration, because culture should be available to all people in all ages for a minimal, and I mean minimal, fee.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about living here in the middle of the country, is that in St. Louis, our zoo is free. You just walk in. The Missouri History Museum is free. You just walk in. I mean, there is edifice after edifice after edifice that really is dedicated to paying an homage to the area and educating people at the same time, that are those kinds of free utilities. And I tell you what, I am happier about that than I am about most things around here. So it does still happen. But, you know, getting back to the Village Voice, that was also, even though it's kind of a loosely organized chain of papers, like I said, the Phoenix New Times is in there. In St. Louis, the Riverfront Times is part of that as well. Creative Loafing down in Tampa, that I was very familiar with for a lot of years, is part of that. And it's one of the few places where you can still find the sort of reporting that can be not only local and extremely so, but can also be unafraid. Well, let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. Not all that long ago, there was an article about the connection between the streetwalkers and the drug trade in St. Louis that was in the Riverfront Times. But they didn't do an expose about what are the cops doing about this. They went and found a guy who went and hired hookers and smoked crack in a hotel room while he was getting blowjobs. So it's that kind of thing. It's like, this is the real story. This is as street level as you can get. And you know that the local paper in town, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, isn't going to touch anything like that ever. But it's a hell of a lot more real than most of the things you'll find in the pages of the Post.
Well, that was the thing about the Village Voice back in the 80s, certainly. I mean, one of the most important and salient things that they would write about, especially at the time and in context, was the AIDS crisis / epidemic.
Yep.
Because certainly mainstream media was not going anywhere near the word AIDS, because if you said AIDS, the implication was you're going to talk about homosexuals.
Right.
So there was a real bias in the mainstream media, no matter how you sliced it. This was the era of Reagan, who never said the word AIDS. You know, if it wasn't for the Village Voice, there would not have been at least a quarter of the exposure necessarily given for the subject, so that people could know more and in depth about it.
Right.
It was a vital part of the New York City community. When I say New York City, I don't mean Manhattan. New York City is five boroughs, and this is the part that really chafes me, especially in these particular times. There are four other boroughs besides Manhattan. New York City is comprised of people who live in the Bronx and Queens and Brooklyn and, of course, Staten Island. You know, we are all from New York City. And the fact that people have such an odd misdirection or disconnect from the concept that five boroughs equal New York City is still a source of amazement and irritation to me. But the thing is that for people back then – who were living in the outer boroughs, who didn't have a connection near them, this was their lifeline as well.
Yeah, because there are people who live in the Bronx who never go into Manhattan, never live their entire lives outside of it, and they're fine.
As are people from Staten Island, which has always mystified me.
Right.
You know, I will tell you a very quick anecdote, going back to the earliest days of me buying The Voice, and that was I went to a private school for high school.
Mm-hmm.
I went to prep school. And I bought The Voice, and I actually came in one day with my copy, and I was just sitting and reading it, and it was actually taken away from me. Why? Because it was looked upon, and I'm not kidding when I say it, looked upon as being something subversive in my prep school.
Damn right it was.
And when I was asked about, well, why are you reading The Voice? Well, because I'm, you know, thinking of going to see a couple of shows this weekend. I got these looks of curiosity rather than the usual scorn, because my classmates couldn't connect the idea of it was a lot more interesting and a lot more gratifying to go and spend your weekend days and or evenings in Manhattan at that time, rather than staying on Staten Island and what? Going out to pick up a dime bag of weed and smoke it up on Rainbow Bridge and Clove Lake Park and then hang out at the mall? Wow.
Yeah.
Isn't that a life?
Now, Woo! here's an odd connection for you, because back in 1983, there was, and this, you mentioned the pop culture connection with the Village Voice and the fact that they were on top of so many different scenes all at once, and you had a lot of talented writers involved. But back in 1983, they trashed an album, and I think it was Christgau who did it, absolutely trashed an album by the Rain Parade called Emergency Third Rail Power Trip. And the reason that's a coincidence is that you had that lined out to talk about today.
Well, I did not know that Christgau had, in fact, done such a thing. So a pox upon him for doing so.
Yep.
Wow. I'm speechless. I may be apoplectic because I'm, you know, I'm just in shock by that. Yes, yes. Emergency Third Rail Power Trip, which was the debut album from LA's The Rain Parade, came out in 83 on the old Black Enigma label, when Enigma was in fact an indie with distribution through the EMI network.
Yep.
It wasn't actually part of capital EMI yet. And I still have my copy of it. They were one of the forerunners and leaders of what became, of course, known as the Paisley Underground. Now, this album, the reason why I wanted to talk about it was I enjoyed our conversation about Fables of the Reconstruction last week so much, I wanted to continue it, or continue in one of those veins and talk about an album that really has not only meant an incredible amount to me emotionally and personally, as well as musically, but has stood the test of time. That's the other main thing. And that album, it was a real watershed moment, in, I think, in American music, because it was during the year that you had albums like Murmur,
yeah,
first, which was obviously the album of the year in 83. Sorry Ma Forgot to Take Out the Trash by The Replacements. No, strike that. Hootenanny was the 83 album.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the Huskers put out Metal Circus. What Makes a Man Start Fires by The Minutemen had come out. The Meat Puppets had made their debut. At the end of 82, the Bangles, who were also part of the Paisley Underground in the LA scene, got their first EP out on Faulty, the self-titled Bangles EP, which I still think was the best thing they've ever done, because that had on it The Real World, which is, I think, probably the best song they will ever have done.
Yep.
I'm very biased towards that record. But it was the Rain Parade who led the way and had a sound that was so rich and so full. And it wasn't so much, I hate using these phrases because they're so in vogue right now, but I have no choice but to use them. They weren't retro psychedelic, neo psychedelic. They were a combination of everything, because they didn't use Vox organs to get that kind of garagey psychedelic sound.
Yeah.
They didn't live on backwards looping. You know, they didn't play that kind of faster Nuggets styled garage psychedelia. Theirs was a much more cerebral, hypnotic sound and feel. I think the closest I could draw parallels to a band, even though I really don't want to, is probably the Byrds. Not with the sound of the Rickenbackers, the way that REM always got approximated with the Byrds, but with the way that the droning was utilized in a way that built the song around the drone. The David Crosby pen songs really were the ones that the Byrds captured that sound and feel on. And Emergency Third Rail Power Trip, which was mainly driven by David Roback, who was kind of the mind of that band, although very, very closely led as well by the incredible Matt Pusey on guitar and vocals. You know, those guys had a melodic style and a sense of writing these beautiful, intelligent, very meaningful oral sculptures. There's not one bad track on that album. There is beauty, and I mean pure beauty, in every single one of those songs. You know, there's a song actually written by Stephen Roback, the bass player and brother of David Roback, called Saturday's Asylum, which which is about as close as you're going to get to being a, you know, loopy psychedelic song, because it has those strange time shifts and signatures that bounce in and out of playfulness, which is what psychedelia was really supposed to be. It was about whimsy. So if you want to talk about a more Syd Barrett-like feel, you would probably take that one and maybe Look at Mary are the two I would think that fit the Pink Floyd vein. But everything else, man, that album, there's just not one bad song. And to me, one of the most important songs in my life, we're talking about not just from that album, but one of the songs that are in my top 10 of all-time favorite songs would be This Can't Be Today, which I see the video, I hear the song, I get chills, sometimes I want to cry. It's a song that I just love so much, that's so moving and so perfect. I cannot tell you how many times I have tried to take that song apart just to rewrite it in fragments in my own way, just to incorporate some of the elements of that song's beauty and unadulterated genius. And God knows, part of my guitar solo style I copped from that song.
Yeah. Well, and what I love about that album, there's a couple of things. I'm glad you mentioned the Byrds, because I think it's clear that without the Byrds Fifth Dimension and probably Rubber Soul and Magical Mystery Tour, this album wouldn't have existed in its current form. But I think that more important about what, with Emergency Third Rail Power Trip, more important than what came before it was what came after it, including Fables of the Reconstruction, including a lot of the sound that Doug Hopkins was able to put together with the Gin Blossoms. And what I dig about it is that on this album, a lot of the time, if you listen closely to what's going on, not even with the production overall, but just with the way that the songs are structured across the stereo, is a lot of times you'll have the drums leaning to the right, you'll have the bass in the center, and you'll have the guitar parts over on the left side, and you've got the keyboards kind of bringing it all together. And what that does is it presents a feeling as though you're in a room listening to a bunch of guys play for you. And I thought that was a very, very clever way to put this thing together. And it also strips away any of the pretense of the production that was going on in 1983 with a lot of stuff where everybody was trying to make two guys and a keyboard sound like a full band. It's the exact flip of that, and it works perfectly.
And now the beauty of this, because this album has been out of print for quite a while, I'm so happy to say that a label called, I believe it's called Wheel Gone Records, has in fact remixed with the vigilant ears of both Matt Pusey and Stephen Roback, remixed this album and have re-released it along with the EP that came out a year after this album, after David Roback had left the band, an EP called Explosions in the Glass Palace, which have two of their more popular songs, You Are My Friend and No Easy Way Down. Now, there's a couple of technical misnomers here saying that includes the unreleased From Emergency Third Rail Power Trip track, Look Both Ways. But Look Both Ways is actually on the CD release, because the original CD release, which came out on Restless Enigma, mm-hmm. has both Emergency Third Rail Power Trip and Explosions in the Glass Palace. So the quote missing track is there. I don't know why they keep touting that. And it's a great song. It's very Buffalo Springfield-like.
Cool.
You know, that's the thing. But the most important fact is that, one, in case most people didn't realize this, the Rain Parade have gotten back together in a variation. I mean, we lost keyboard player Will Glenn back in, I think, 1999 or 2000 at cancer. So he's been gone for a while. David Roback, of course, left the Rain Parade right after Emergency Third Rail Power Trip to form first Opal. And then Mazzy Star. When the Rain Parade split up in 1986, 87, right after I saw them, I thought, God, we'll never see the likes of them again. And a couple of years ago, they got back together. I think they recorded the first gig back together and released it privately for anybody who wanted to buy a copy, which I did. Sound terrific. I mean, just so happy to see them out there again. I'm praying that they come to New York at a point, because I don't care how old any of us are, I would go see them in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
And now this album is coming back out. So even though I have it, I have my original vinyl copy and I have my CD pressing, I will go get this because I want to hear how this was revisited.
Yes.
And I wonder if they're now in that same room that you're in and hearing it as a as an all-encompassing physical presence while you're listening to the CD and or album. I want to see if they've been able to do that the right way.
I hope so, because it sounds so great in its original form.
But, you know, I was going to say the whole thing about the Paisley Underground is that a lot of the bands have, in fact, gotten back together. The Long Riders have reappeared. The 3 o'clock have gotten back together. The Bangles are together. So, you know, I'm not sure if Green on Red are back full time, but I know that they got together. They all played a gig together called Paisley Underground Revisited out in LA. I would have loved to have seen that brought to New York. Believe me.
One of the things that the Village Voice, getting back to the whole beginning of this, dinged them for was the fact that the vocals sounded so sleepy and uninteresting, in their words. And I thought, you know, that the whole reason for that sort of sleepy vibe about the vocals, I think, was to, again, provide a little bit of contrast to what the songs were about, first of all, especially when you get into something that's as deep and emotional as something like Carolyn's song.
I heard that you said that you feel all alone. Did you think that they could when they told you go ahead? Is it in your head? Are you upside down? You drive around.
You have to have something that's not screaming that in your face. And again, look at what we were coming out of. We were coming out of punk and into the first, well, kind of the second new wave. And there was a lot of that still in your face going on. So again, what did Rain Parade do? Brought it back and said, here, listen to this, but really listen to it.
Right. They made it a lot more melodic,
yep,
and slower and folkier and more pastoral. You know, it shows kind of the hypocrisy of a rock writer, because, you know, what the hell was Murmur? I mean, as much as I love that album, what the fuck was Michael Stipe talking about?
Yep.
Do I know now after all these years? No. Do I care? No. All I care about is the fact that I love those songs. And the thing is, when you listen to the vocals on Emergency Third Rail Power Trip, you know, it's supposed to be, dare I say it, a little trippy. To get it to have that kind of feel, you can't really hear it. You're not supposed to hear it. It's supposed to be slightly enigmatic and mysterious, because if it's up front, then it's not really very psychedelic. You know, it's not going to do for you what you want it to do if you're out there with the, you know, getting the message and the storyline across. You know, listen carefully and closely in closed quarters, in headphones, in the quiet. Listen to the words. You will pick them up. You will, especially this Can't Be Today, which you can't hear on first glimpse, but all you know is that this melody is going to take you by the heart, and it's going to lead you down this path going, my God, this is some of the most incredible music I've ever heard.
Yeah, in the list of essentials, Emergency Third Rail Power Trip, absolutely there. And we've got a few other things to get into as far as new music. We'll get into the political scene as well just a little bit. And I want to kick off with the new stuff with a young lady by the name of Audrey X. You're going to have to give some background on her because, well, she's got a very European style, a very European feel about a lot of the music, but she doesn't have an accent. Where is she from?
Yeah, she's from Stockholm, Sweden.
Aha!
We were wondering if you have a room to rent.
But she doesn't. I tell you what, she doesn't sound like it a bit when she's singing.
No, she's got that, dare I say it, that kind of coolly European disconnect or distance that they seem to have in the dance scene. And maybe that's a generalization by me, but because this is kind of out of my wheelhouse, frankly. But I thought, you know, this is an interesting track. And, you know, I'm not gaga on playing safe every time.
Right.
And it was nice to be able to premiere something different. One thing I find interesting is that her whole thing is based around doing singles, not just throwing an album out there. She is actually someone who came out of a church choir, decided she wanted to continue singing, and has been singing once a week in a professional setting with a vocal coach since she was a kid. So she's got the trained voice.
Yeah.
And I just find it a little... I don't like the word edgy, but it's certainly out of my comfort zone, and I think that's what I found appealing about it. And she's nice to look at, so that there's your selling point.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, do I give a shit about dance music? No. Is she nice to look at? Sure. So, okay, there's your selling point for me, and it's a good song. So it's a 2-for-1 win.
Right, and that's the thing is, it's danceable, but I would have trouble even just putting this into the dance music box alone, because this is just, it's a good, solid pop song. It's a lot of fun to listen to.
And you know what? It makes you think, okay, she's put out this single, now what comes next?
Yep.
Does she do something in the same vein, or is she adventurous?
Right. Yeah, I'd like to hear a little bit more of her voice just to get a better feel for what kind of range she has, what kind of tricks she has up her sleeve in terms of singing, because it's clear. I mean, the voice is there. And again, she doesn't push it. She doesn't she doesn't monkey around with a lot of the things that female vocalists are told to do. She just sings the song. So I'd like to hear a little bit more ranginess about her and find out if she's got it, because I bet she does.
I want to hear her do like a straight out rock track, you know, something that you can imagine somebody like Ann Wilson is able to do. Let's see if this girl can do it. That's the mark of a great singer.
Yep. So check out Black Skies by Audrey X, and the review is up from Rob Ross on Pop Dose. We've got a band to talk about as well. And again, impressive. Anytime somebody can make a pop trio happen in a way that sounds not only capable, I hate using that word because it sounds like a slam. It's like, well, it's capable. I mean it to mean so much more than that, because it's so easy for a pop trio to sound incapable of filling a void. And Summerdale, wow, do they do it great.
Well, like you and I have talked about ad infinitum over the years we've been doing this, so too in the drinking water of New Jersey, although it's probably pollution of one form or another. Much like the city of Chicago, these incredible – New Jersey seems to be growing these incredible new power pop bands one after the other, which is such an incredibly great thing to see and hear. And once again, thankfully, the Pied Piper himself, the marvelous maven, Marty Scott of Gem Records, saw and heard Summerdale. They had an album out called Shake It Maggie. Once he heard it, he said, I've got to have them, signed them to Gem, sent them back into the studio. They recorded some new songs, and now they're re-releasing this record as Maggie Says It Again. So now it's 15 songs worth. And this band goes from one end of the pop spectrum to the other. I only have one minor complaint about this record, and it may be, and I think it's a valid one at that, and that's it could have withstood a little bit better mixing in the post-production.
Okay.
It could have been a bit more explosive to really beef up the bass and drums. That's all I can complain about. But when you hear these songs, your immediate thoughts go to everybody and anybody. You've got, and from a trio, that makes it even more salient. You've got from the likes of Badfinger, Cheap Trick, Big Star, Queen.
Yep.
You know? These guys are so good and so on it, and I mean on it. There's a song on there actually called Coolest Kid in the Room, and it's kind of the new wave song, if you will. You know, it's the new wave. I don't want to call it a pastiche. It's more like a tribute, because I don't think they're kids. They may be near, if not in our age range.
Yeah.
But they certainly know how to get that sound and get it right. Whereas on the flip side of that, you've got a song called Feel the Magic, which is kind of their T-Rex-like stomper. Don't you feel the magic when I touch you? Don't you feel the magic when we kiss? Don't you feel the magic when I hold brilliant, and it's clever. The songs are catchy, they're hooky, the vocals are there, the harmonies are there, and boy oh boy oh boy does this band know how to use their guitars the right way.
And it's the one at least that they were playing in the live video that you've got linked on the page is a Gibson SG, and it's an interesting choice because most of the guys I know who sling an SG do so in a way of playing a very specifically trebly kind of lead guitar. You think of Angus Young, I guess, is the obvious example, but you also think about guys like Derek Trucks, and it's always that, you know, they've got a very big bassy band behind them, and they're just that sort of overlay. So using that as a more rhythm instrument was an interesting choice to go with, but I think he does it really well.
What's interesting is the use of the SG has come back into vogue for the last, I'd say, maybe really come back. I'm talking about the way it has. I'd say in the last 10 or so years.
Yeah.
That really exploded. I mean, I seem to notice them more once I got mine. You know, but the thing is, I couldn't afford a Gibson before that. That's why it took me so long to get an SG. But you know, you think about some of the other players of this kind of musical ilk that used the SG. I mean, Pete Ham used George Harrison's.
Right.
He gave it to him.
Mm-hmm.
What's his name from Slade? Dave Hill.
Yeah.
From Slade used a, and there, it's funny, there's a song on here called Merry Christmas Time, which is possibly the best Christmas song I've heard since Merry Christmas Everybody by Slade, even though I hate Christmas songs.
Right.
You know, of course, Townsend used an SG, and Harrison used one, and Weller used one, and Clapton used one, and Beck used one. I mean, everybody used an SG at one time or another. I use an SG, you know. It's just a case of, it's a cool-looking guitar, and
yeah,
you can do a lot of different things with it, sonically speaking, and if you know how to use it the right way. But like you brought up, they tend to use it on the unnecessarily trebly end. But then again, look at Tony Iommi. He's always used an SG.
Right.
And it ain't that trebly.
No, very true. And the other great thing about an SG is that you can play one at a gig for 4 hours and not feel like you've got an anchor tied around your neck.
Which is the exact opposite of a Les Paul, which is why so many people really started to eschew using them.
Yep.
There's been a big bunch of conversation with a lot of my friends saying, you know what, I'd rather use some of these Japanese knockoffs, which sound just as good, play just as well, and don't kill my back.
Yeah, weigh half as much, no doubt about it. But still, there is nothing like the feel of a true Les Paul as well. So, but either way, I mean, this is just, they're a great band. They're an interesting trio to check out. They're one that you've got to listen to and really get an appreciation for what they put together here. So Maggie Says It Again, out and available now. And you brought up Gem Records and the fact that they do that kind of publicity in exactly the right way. Not only are they very on tone when it comes to picking bands and signing bands, but they're also very good at being able to promote them in a way that makes sense for them and a way that makes sense for the band. You get a lot of CDs and a lot of pitch sheets and things like that that come across your desk. I get a ton of emails from publicists all over the place who want airtime. And it's kind of the same bit. And I'll tell you, there's some real crap publicity people out there right now. It's awful.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because we started to go down this path last week about the, you know, why it is there are all these you know, problems with pitching your band and
yep,
so on and so forth. Let's start with a couple of the really glaringly obvious ones. The lack of being able to write in the structured English language like any of us were probably taught if we went to school. And I'm not saying that in a condescending or patronizing way. Where the fuck were you when it came to basic English 101?
Yep.
Your spelling is horrific. It's an embarrassment. And the way you structure sentences and your inability to write contractions is shameful. Your, there, and there.
Right.
If you don't know which one goes where, get the fuck out of the business.
Yeah.
Now. Okay, let's just start with that because that's really offensive to me. Number two, coming at me with some of the pitches, I find it's a lot of the same kind of repetitive, what I call too cool for school kind of pseudo hip speak.
Yep.
Who are you trying to sell this to? Because certainly anyone with a professional background and some longevity in either the writing field or the music field in general, this is as transparent as you can get. You're talking shit. You're spewing, you're perpetrating verbiage that just does not need to be because it is not going to track me to what you're trying to foist upon me.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, do not do the comparison in your pitch. It's one thing if you and I talk about, if you like this band, you know, you're going to love this band because you want to give, you want to be able to say, I've listened to it. So here's my comparison and weigh in because there's a parallel here. You can draw from the experience of having listened to it. But don't fucking say to me, if you like Metallica, you're going to love such and such.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to work on me because all you're doing is selling me a band that I've already heard the shit. And will you please stop with trying to come up with catchy little phrases like, you know, cutting edge and you know, or, you know, classifying your musicians as dark wave folk or soul folk. No such thing exists.
Right.
Publicists do a grand disservice to their acts by spewing out all of these things. It hurts the acts and it hurts the possibility of interest. But the most egregious of all to me is one, when a publicist sends out a campaign so prematurely, you know, as a writer, as I'm sure my colleagues on PopDose get, as you get, we are inundated by emails, we are inundated by physical product, we are inundated by requests to be heard, and, you know, will you do an interview, and will you do a review, and will you do this, that, and the other. I work a day job. I think every one of my colleagues at PopDose work a day job. You work a day job. Yep. You know, we don't have time to – this is not our jobs. This is our joy. But there's also a limit and a line that you shouldn't cross, and when they come at you with these campaigns in such a premature vein. You know, the album's not coming out till November. Why are you sending it in August? That's number one. That's going to hurt your artist. But number two is you send out an item. You ask for a premiere. I look at it and I think, okay, I'll give you a premiere. I need this, and this from you. I need the elements that will make up the body of the premiere. I need the album art. I need a bio. I need a link. And so on. And you don't get back to me. And then I tell you, I'm going to run it this Friday. The premiere will be up on Friday. And you come back the day before after I've spent the time and the effort and the energy to do all this because you didn't get back to me. I had to go look for the information and piece it together. And you come back to me and you say to me, well, that's too soon. Can we do this or move it to that date? No. You have to understand something, publicists. We're the ones doing you the favor.
Right.
You could be a lot nicer and a lot more professional about it instead of expecting us to do this for you. You asked us and we complied. We complied nicely. We complied professionally. We asked for the elements, the assets, call them what you want. Don't you dare come back 24 hours after I spent the time cobbing this together because you didn't respond to my reply to you saying what I needed and then tell me, well, it's premature. And I tell you point blank, you have one of two options. Either it goes up tomorrow or it doesn't go up at all.
Yeah.
Because I am not going to move something else of mine that waited its turn and got its space because you're now telling me you think it's – you don't make my schedule. It's that simple.
What you're talking about is a much larger issue because it's not just as far as music publicists are concerned, but the thing that they tend to lose sight of is that they're working for a band. I mean, they're technically, even though they're not in the employ of, they're supposed to be working in the best interest of the music. And if they're getting in our way of doing that, they're doing a disservice to everybody, including the people who are supposed to be listening to the music. So it's a much bigger thing than just that, because the real heart of the matter is that email... here I go again about being the neo-Luddite. Email has fucked up everything. The fact that you can mass blast out an email, I have a few people that I work with a lot who are not only music publicists, but they deal with other things as well. They do book publicity and they do all kinds of things to try to connect an artist or a creative person with the radio audience through me. That's the way that normally happens. And I have a few people that I work with a lot because Sal and Alan and a few other guys understand that it's about a relationship. And what I'll get from Alan is not a one-sheeter that is just a, you know, a generic one-sheeter about you should play this band. What I get from him is, I know what you like and I know who your audience is. I think this is a guy that would fit well.
Yes.
Build a relationship, for Christ's sake. Do that, and you'll get a whole lot farther than just, here's the generic one sheet I sent to 4 million other guys that I'm hoping I get 1% of.
If I was to read some of these to you, we could actually do this on one of the upcoming shows.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of like, you know, kids' letters to, you know, to Santa Claus. You know, that's the kind of nonsense this is, and it's so embarrassing because it's so sophomoric, but what you just said is absolutely correct. I'd say there are about 7 to 10 publicists I've worked with now in the years that I've been doing this again, on a regular basis that I have fomented an actual relationship with. They know what to send. Okay, one of them tends to go a little overboard, but I give him a pass simply because he's been at this game for 30 plus years as well.
Right.
Him, I'll give a pass, and he's trying to do this as a living. But the others are, they're not just professionals, they're music lovers. That's the key component. They know what the hell they're talking about. Music, books, whatever it is. Like you said, it's not just music, but they're the professionals because they work for the band and for the record label, perhaps.
Right.
They know what needs to be done and who it should go to. Who is the best, most reasonable source that would give this the time of day?
Yeah.
In a period when nobody will give you the time of day. Now, if you send me your generic blast with, hey, first of all, get my name right. If you can't get my name right from the first time you send me a generic blast, I'm telling you right now, you will never get a fucking review out of me because that's just really negligent and lazy. But when you send me, you know, about your cutting edge new band, you know, Smelly Ball Cheese, do you really think I'm going to sit there and go, this is up my alley?
Yeah, right.
I don't think so.
Well, their early stuff was okay, but, you know, lately they've become really kind of complacent, I think. But but either way, yes, they need to do their jobs better. And really what it comes down to is if you don't give a shit about me or my audience, I know you don't really give a shit about your band either.
That's true. And I think a lot of bands really need to take stock of the people that they've got working for them because a lot of these bands will never be heard from again. I will tell you that I've had the best amount of luck from bands themselves who have sent their albums in, their submissions, with a direct letter of appeal. Now, whether or not they're speaking the truth, I don't know, but they say that, you know, after hearing your shows and reading your reviews on Popdose, et cetera, you know, they've done their homework, and we think it would place well with you.
Right, right,
okay,
exactly.
That's good enough for me then. Let me give you a chance and a listen. If I like it, great. If
that's
not,
the thing. Yeah, that will at least get you a listen. That will at least get your foot in the door. So, yeah, that's a great way to put it. And, again, we'll I'm sure this is a topic we will revisit and take everybody further down the lines of in the future.
Yes, indeed. Maybe we can have a guest, one of our Popdose brethren or sister, and join us and
definitely
see what feeling on the topic might be.
Well, definitely. And the thing about it is, again, it's the music and the listener that end up suffering because people aren't doing their jobs right. So there's a reason why this is important beyond just the fact that so many publicists are crap. So that said, we have a bunch... Over these last couple of days, we've seen speech after speech after speech, and a lot has been made of Donald Trump and his ability to go from being that asshole at the Phoenix pep rally or Bund meeting or whatever it was, and then giving the prepackaged teleprompter speech the next day and sounding like he wasn't a complete lunatic, which is about as good as you can possibly expect from this guy. But the speech on Afghanistan, I thought, was so fatally flawed in so many ways that had nothing to do with Afghanistan policy, because the one thing he did not address in that speech was any Afghanistan policy. Why the fuck did we sit through that?
Because it was another what's he going to say next moment.
Yep.
That's what all of these are. That's what every single one of these things are. These are all media spectacles now. And, of course, right after the Afghanistan speech, he pardons Joe Arpaio.
Right. Friday when there's a hurricane.
While Sebastian Gorka is no longer part of the White House.
No, he went back to Breitbart.
And then you have, of course, Trump waffling on whether or not he's going to go to Texas. I mean, this is just a guy that hasn't got a fucking clue about anything.
Right.
And, you know, I'm as really dog-tired as you can possibly be with the left, because that's become my whipping post right now, and I'm really – and we'll get to that in a moment to this week. But, you know, Donald Trump is just – I'm sorry, but I think I have to finally say, as much as I disdain of someone like Mike Pence, I would really rather him be president.
Right.
We just kind of stumble our way through the next 3 years, but let's just get Donald Trump the fuck out of office.
Well, right. We've had Pence before. I mean, if you take a good look at Calvin Coolidge, he was pretty much Mike Pence. And it wasn't great during the Coolidge years, but we made it. So it's got that going for it. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the left has been no better in this. And the latest from the right is that, Paul Ryan stuck it up Trump's ass again about something today, but the fact is he's not going to do anything. So yeah, you can say, well, I disagree with him pardoning Joe Arpaio, but that spineless jerk isn't going to do a damn thing about it. So who cares if you agree or disagree, Paul? You're not doing anything. What's the point of disagreeing?
Placating your base means absolutely nothing without actions afterwards.
Right. So hit the left, and then I'll circle back around to that, because I'm going to hit a guy for exactly the same thing.
Well, as we've gotten to this now, beyond ludicrous, insane, ridiculous crescendo of being offended for the sake of being offended, this is where the left has gone. We are talking now, and I'm being dead serious about censoring everything, because everything is just so offensive because someone is sensitive, or, it's misconstrued as racist. And somebody very cleverly put it, because I mean, people have to get rid of, like, here's one thing that happened this week, which I'm sure you heard about. A fellow who works for ESPN named Robert Lee.
Yes.
Could not broadcast the Virginia game under the circumstances. To me, which is about as loony, as insane as it was. And if I'm not mistaken, he is Asian.
Yes, he is. That is correct.
What the fuck is wrong with you people? Let's just start with that right there. That's, somebody very cleverly said, we're going to have to do it with Lee genes. Are people going to be upset if you speak rational Lee?
Right.
Honest Lee? It made me start bursting into song, actually, of the Lees from Old Virginia from 1776, because that pretty much says it all right there. But that we may be making light of it, but here's where it got really insane in New York. There's a woman who works under Mayor Scumbag de Blasio named Melissa Mark Viverito, who's just got a trail of shit going behind her to begin with.
Yeah,
it's one of his flunkies on the city board. And I don't know if she's got designs on running for mayor, certainly not in this election, but designs perhaps after this next mayoral race is over with and things develop as they will fall out. But she decided to raise a hue and cry this week about the statue of Christopher Columbus that sits in Columbus Circle in Manhattan.
Yeah.
It was racist and offensive. Now, Melissa Mark Viverito is also a woman who welcomed with open arms. This is not an exaggeration. This is not me grinding my gears. This is a fact. Welcomed with open arms and demanded that a known FALN terrorist and bomber who had served time for his crimes be the grand marshal at this year's Puerto Rican Day Parade. So much so that the New York City police wanted to do nothing with it, and so many sponsors pulled out from it that it made this year's parade an absolute shambles. We're talking about a woman who, in fact, was championing a known convicted terrorist. Keyword, known convicted terrorist. But yet a statue that's been sitting out in Columbus Circle is now offensive. All of a sudden, everybody's offended by this statue or that statue. What's going to happen next? Will we be taking down? Jesus, I don't even know whose statues we're going to be taking down. I'm at a loss. I'm really at a loss for this, because people have just gotten completely off their rocker, and every one of these are these typical virtue signaling left wing or ultra left wing, not just social justice warriors, but these liars who, will throw the word racism in at the drop of a hat. Well, guess what? If you don't take some measure of responsibility within your own communities as to what you're doing, like Melissa Mark Viverito claims that she's Puerto Rican, not the fact that she's Hispanic in general, but, she makes it very clear she's Puerto Rican, but she's championing someone who is a Puerto Rican terrorist.
Yeah.
There's a real schism right there. But that's just a microcosm of what's happening with everybody on the left.
Exactly. You
know, Black Lives Matter. Well, I'll tell you what. When shit starts to go down in your neighborhoods and you're calling for the cops and they don't show up, I'll wonder why.
Yeah, well, and there's a couple of things that actually parallel that, because I'm glad you started with the statues, because it goes right to what I wanted to talk about. Terry McAuliffe is the governor of Virginia, and obviously he's been dealing with all of this in the aftermath of Charlottesville and the fact that he's got Nazis in his backyard or whoever they, you know, these neo-Nazi punk ass, whatever they are. But the thing about Terry McAuliffe is he, on CNN this morning, exemplified exactly what you're talking about and exemplified the problem with the fact that you have so little time now to make a statement about anything or to digest any given issue, that if you're not terribly bright, which I don't think Terry McAuliffe is, you're going to end up saying something that doesn't make any sense, and it makes you a symbol for the problem. So what he did is they were talking about the statues and the fact that he's now calling for all of the Confederate statues to come down in Virginia, which I'm fine with because fuck those people. They tried to tear the country apart. We shouldn't have statues to them. So that's fine. But I always felt that way. And that was that's the problem, is that CNN very cleverly brought up a piece of tape from Terry McAuliffe earlier on, in which he said, and he had just taken some step to sort of make the Confederacy a little bit more in the background, and I can't even remember at this point what it was, but on that piece of tape, he said, well, let's go ahead and do this, but we'll leave the statues alone. The statues are fine. So now here we are a couple of years later, and Terry McAuliffe, the same guy, is saying, no, we need to take all the statues down. They're racist and horrible. And CNN said, so were you wrong then? And I think it was Jake Tapper. And he said, were you wrong then? And the answer to that question is, yeah, I was wrong then. I'm right now. Those things were always a problem. They should never have gone up. They shouldn't have been there in the first place, and they should have been taken down at the first opportunity. So yeah, when I said the statues are okay, I was wrong. Terry McAuliffe didn't do that. He said, well, I was taking things incrementally, and, you know, we just had taken this other step over here, and so now, you know, those statues, and he used this term, and when the phrase came out of his mouth, I wanted to pop him one. He said, well, those statues became racist. Bullshit! No, they didn't become racist. And that's the problem, is that on the right, the argument is, well, they keep moving the goalposts. Now something that used to be okay isn't okay anymore. How come, and how am I supposed to keep up with all of this shit? And Terry McAuliffe walked right into it because there's no nuance in what he had to say. Because he's not real bright and he didn't think about it. And if you think about it, you come to the conclusion that, yeah, they put those statues up as a direct fuck you. Yeah, slaves, you're free now, but don't forget, we had these guys and we're going to put statues up to them. You're going to have to walk by every day and remember this shit because we'll come after you at the first opportunity with swords again. That's why they were there. Of course they were racist 100 years ago. Of course they were racist 2 years ago. And what he should have said was, yeah, I was wrong. But he's a politician, and it's the worst. That's the thing that drives people crazy about politicians, is that they will do anything other than use logic and admit that they could have fucked up.
Well, there's that end of it. But now here's the rest of the Melissa Mark Vivarino comedy with the Columbus statue. She is able to somehow convince Mayor Asshole into – and this is the part that really – and it should make you and everybody else who hears this angry – convinced him to have a study done, which now is going to cost the taxpayers.
Uh-huh.
A study done as to whether or not other statues – should be removed from various locations around the New York area. Now, we're at a time in the city where we have the highest rate of homelessness since David Dinkins was mayor.
Uh-huh.
We have the highest rate of, and not just homeless, but junkies and very undesirable people out on the streets in all the boroughs.
Yep.
In a way that we didn't have under neither Giuliani or Bloomberg. New York is not as safe as it was, I don't feel. It's very uncomfortable. You know, you're back to looking around you and over your shoulder at every turn. She's now got him spending this money where it could be diverted to trying to find some measure, and I'm saying some measure, a crumb, of a way to make things run just a little bit smoother on the MTA, the Metropolitan Transit Authority, because this has been known in the local media as the summer of hell because of all the problems that have taken place throughout Penn Station and all the domino effect that it right. has from Amtrak to the Long Island Railroad to Metro North and New Jersey Transit, and of course affecting the subway systems here. She's pushed him into this posturing together. They're posturing. I don't know who their base is for this, that they think that's going to generate them votes, because he has managed to – he's never had a fan base on Staten Island. He's probably most reviled here.
Yeah.
Just cause. Now, I voted for him thinking he was the right guy for the job when it was him versus the old MTA boss, Joe Loda, who is a moron of the highest order. And he's not even a New Yorker. Mm-hmm. By the way, the postscript is that he's back in charge of the MTA again.
Oh, great.
Just great. So I voted for de Blasio under best circumstances as a Democrat and as somebody who thought that, God, I don't want Christine Quinn to be mayor. She would be even more horrific than Bloomberg was, and it would be another 4 years of Bloomberg. Well, de Blasio got in. Of course, as well you know, never once did he send out the snow plows in Staten Island when we got hit with some major snowstorms. So that was the start of the antagonism towards Staten Island.
And let me stop you there for just a second. How is that different than Bridgegate?
It's not.
Right. Okay. Just thought I would get that clear. Right. Sure.
Right. Oh, well, there's a whole laundry list of things. Like, he's got this notorious list of pay-to-play people that he's got emails from, and, you know, he doesn't want to let the emails, even though he claims to be the most transparent mayor we've got, emails, you know. He's incredibly antagonistic, not just towards Staten Island and parts of Queens and parts of the Bronx and even pockets of Brooklyn, but he's really antagonistic with the press. I mean, really, he's – at least Donald Trump engages them so he can fight with them.
Right.
You know what I mean? De Blasio just goes right for the jugular. And he also is incredibly, notoriously inappropriate with – when he goes to do these town hall meetings, if you ask him something that challenges him, he goes after you or shuts you down. He doesn't let you answer. He's a gutless wonder is what he is. He's also a sham of a mayor. He's incompetent. Oh, and by the way, for a guy who talks about, you know, riding the subways in a greener city and now wanting to inflict a millionaire tax to pay for the MTA, which I think we talked about this last week, but he has no right to do it. None whatsoever. He doesn't take the subways, only when there's a photo op. Only when there's a photo op. He has his, you know, his armed car that he goes in, his Esplanade, and or Escalator, whatever the fuck the car is called. He gets taken by you know, a
police escort. Yeah.
Yep. Just so he can go to the gym. You know, things like that. This guy is the same guy who also, when a police officer was murdered on the streets of New York, he was off to Germany to be part of that you know, lefty bullshit anti-Trump rally.
Yeah, all right, because that's what's important to the people of New York.
Well, this is what he is. So fuck him and fuck it. Sorry, I really didn't want to go down that route, but you know what? I just want to say, fuck de Blasio, fuck Mark Viverito, fuck that other woman who runs the schools department. I'm going to tell a really quick story about that one because it's all part and parcel of this whole citywide thing. This woman, Carmen Farina, I think her name is, she's the chancellor of the schools. There is a woman on Staten Island who is legally blind. She has two children. The older of the two is about to start preschool. The nearest preschool for this woman to be able to walk with her daughters and with her dog to get to the school and deliver her safely and come home safely is 6 minutes. They wouldn't give her a clearance to let her daughter in that school. The nearest school for her daughter would be basically an hour and change away.
Ugh.
Okay, let's start with that. Do anything about it. You know, she wouldn't give any answers until New York One, which is a local New York cable-only news network, got involved. People saw this, and the nearest YMCA called this woman and said, look, we're 15 minutes by foot from you. Your daughter can come here.
Yeah.
15 minutes is a world of difference from an hour, but this fucking woman who's part of this shitty school system where the kids are just getting dumber and worse and not taught, but yet allowed to pass their way through. This woman who pats herself on the back with doing such a stupendous job couldn't be bothered to make an exception for one girl because her mother is blind.
Yeah,
this
right.
is the kind of shit you've got in the de Blasio government. But de Blasio and his cronies, oh, forget it.
Yeah.
Forget it. They get a pass everywhere.
Hey, you know, if we can find a good statue to take down as a PR move, though, hey, everything will be fine.
All the taxpayers put the bill for this.
Exactly. Robert Ross, John Grayson, it's Radio City. We got one more quick thing to hit before we get to the In Our Heads segment for this week. And it goes back to, again, something we had talked about last time around, because with the movies getting worse and worse and with the experience getting worse and worse at the theaters, there should be some hope, and it doesn't appear that there is. You're kicking this one around a little bit in your head, Rob. What'd you come up with?
Well, I was thinking about, you and I had talked about the movies that had a lot of high hopes pinned on them.
Yep.
You know, the summer blockbusters that weren't, really. That's what it boils down to.
Yeah.
I mean, the hype, and I do mean hype, behind Atomic Blonde is my main point of reference here. Every time you turned around, every other commercial was for that movie.
Yep.
And the tie-ins with vodka and all this sort of stuff. It flopped, and it flopped badly. And I'm guessing that in another maybe 2-3 weeks tops, it'll be on pay-per-view already, because they're going to try and make some bones back from that.
And unfortunately, you know? It'll probably work. Between that and the foreign market, they'll make the money that they need to make.
You know, it's just I don't see it with what the studios are trying to do. You know, it kind of confounded me, and I actually looked this up about Guardians of the Galaxy number 2, because it didn't seem like it was in the theaters all that long, and now it's on pay-per-view.
Yeah.
And I looked at, I actually watched it yesterday, and it's really good. It's I'd say on par with the first one, which was highly entertaining and funny. But then again, it's Marvel, and Marvel knows how to market, you know?
Right.
The thing is that I looked it up because I was just in doubt that it was that much of a success, and it turned out it was more successful than the first one. But I think the thing is with theaters now, they'll give you a short life run in the theater and then go right to the DVD so you can sell it there, thereby negating the concept of the blockbuster factor. Case in point, Spider-Man was a huge bang over its opening weekend. And after that opening weekend, went down very rapidly. And then you didn't hear about it. It was gone from the theaters. I'm pretty sure by next week it'll be on pay-per-view and DVD.
Right.
But all of these movies that, you know, you and I were pulling out last week, the ones that they were touting as the big deals for the summer, like that – what was the one that you went to see, that CG film?
Oh, Wonder Woman.
No, not Wonder Woman. The other more recent one.
Oh, yeah, right.
Thing.
Yeah, Valerian.
Right. That's a flop.
Yep.
That's a big-ass flop. And yet these are the only movies that were rolled out during the summer. I mean, you know, when you and I were kids, here's a perfect example. In 1 week, the three big blockbusters that were rolled out for that week were Star Wars, Smokey and the Bandit, and it was a Charlie Brown movie.
Okay.
I think it was the one where they go to the summer camp.
You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown?
No, that was the very first
one. That was the first one. Okay, yeah.
That's the first. Snoopy Come Home was the second. This was the third one. But anyway, it was the one where they go to the summer camp, and that did gangbusters.
Yeah.
You know, because you had three different types of audiences. You had your basic comedy audience for Smokey and the Bandit. You had the Charlie Brown movie for kids and families, and you had Star Wars, which was for everybody.
Right.
Right across. You know, and all three were box office boffo. Okay? You're not going to get that in this day and age. You
no.
know, you're going to get this, okay, they're going to release this. I'm releasing this week, so you're going to release your movie next week to offset my first week, because you don't want to go head-to-head in that first week.
Well, yeah, and keep in mind the fact that Star Wars came out that week you were talking about. I was 7, almost 8, and Star Wars came out on VHS when I was 14. So,
and to give you the time compare, I was 12, so I was on the cusp of teendom.
Yeah,
right. Just this was the summer that punk rock began.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this was the summer of Sam. This was 2 months before the death of the king of rock and roll.
Right,
1976. This was the month before the New York City blackout.
Yeah.
Okay. it came out on VHS tape when I had graduated high school.
Exactly.
And I was 18, and get this, and The Revenge of the Jedi was in the theaters.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And that was the big deal, is that you could finally see a VHS copy of Star Wars. And now, I mean, there's no scarcity anymore. So nothing special. But the other little side note to that is about the foreign market, because if you want to know why, the stories were better and they were, and the characters were more fleshed out, and there was more of a reason to get emotionally involved with the story between Han Solo and Princess Leia, or whatever it was. I mean, pick it, from 1977 all the way through. And that there isn't now, and that there's a whole bunch of characters that you just don't care about, and there's no reason to get emotionally invested while you're sitting back and having this visual spectacular happen. It's because most of the foreign markets, they don't want to spend the money in places like India and China to translate the movies and do overdubs and do what we used to do with foreign films that were brought to the States, because who wants to sit there and read them? They don't even spend the money on subtitles anymore. They show them as we see them in American theaters in Delhi, you know? It's the same thing. So most of the people aren't going to hear the dialogue or give a crap about the stories. They're going there to look at a movie. That's it. And that's where most of that foreign bank comes from, is from people who do not understand a word of the dialogue that's said on screen. So what do? They make a movie where it doesn't matter if you hear a single word of it. So get used to more of that.
Here's the other thing, though. Movies that you've seen recently, and let's stretch it a couple of years. What was the last time that you actually were emotionally invested in the movie you were watching? Where you actually cared about what happened from start to finish, instead of looking at your watch going, when is this going to end? Or I've got to go to the bathroom.
There have been some recent ones, but they're all art house films. They're not anything anybody would even recognize the name of.
That's a major problem, because it's fine for like you to go to an art house movie, for me to have spent so many years in the mid to late 80s going to only those kinds of films because such shit was coming out on the market. But the thing is that, you know, don't forget, in the late 80s, you had crappy movies like Heart Beeps.
Oh, yeah.
Or, I don't remember the name. It was a fucking movie with Dudley Moore and some kid where father and son switch. It's like the umpteenth remake of Freaky Friday, except as, you know, father and son.
They did 100 of those. Yeah, Judge Reinhold even did one.
I couldn't remember the name of the one that he did either, so that's why I left his out. But that turned out 0 for 2. But, I mean, you had tons of those movies, so our options were to go to the art houses. And it's funny that we're using that phrase. You know, it's like the more esoteric cinemas, which don't even exist anymore in New York City, which, again, that's yet another topic of why New York sucks.
Yeah.
Now. But the thing is that there are some movies that you can watch and get really into and really dig the – listen, say what you will. I was complete – for whatever reason, I was really absorbed into Superbad when that came out.
Right.
You actually wanted to see something – good happened for both Seth and Evan. You know, you got really absorbed into Knocked Up. I'm sorry. That's a movie that's impossible not to get drawn into.
Yeah.
You know, I really felt deeply and emotionally for both, you know, Brennan Huff and Dale Doback and Step Brothers, because, you know, a family like that is kind of hard to cobble together. And, you know, like Dale Doback said, you know, for now we've got a family and it's all wrecked. You know, that's emotionally moving, especially with the fact that they worked so hard to make that video for Boats and Hoes. You know, you emotionally invest in certain, but they're few and far between. You know, that you really are. It's a sad statement that you know that we're all there cheering and then screaming. You know, when Han Solo comes on the screen, and then when he dies.
Yeah.
In The Force Awakens.
Yep.
Because there's the investment coming back to life.
Right, that started in 1977. So, yeah. Well, on that happy note, yeah, the pay-per-view thing was supposed to fix things, and it just didn't. It seems to have made things worse. And that's why a lot of what's going on that's interesting is either at the art houses or it's on streaming only. It's things that never get a release in the theaters, and there's a sadness about that as well. But that does bring us to the In Our Head segment for this week. We got a couple of things to talk over, and I have to ask you, Rob, to go back into your memory banks, because I've got one of two directions I'm going to go with our In Our Heads thing this week. Have we talked about 90125?
Wasn't that that show with Shannon Doherty?
Okay, so I had this argument online. It wasn't even really an argument. I made a statement online about what I considered to be my sort of albums of the 80s. And 90125 was one of the ones that I listed. And I didn't...
I think I answered this question online.
Yeah.
Remember the fucking answer. Actually, I know the answers.
But yeah, the thing about that album is I didn't assume it to be a controversial choice. I mean, when that one came out, I think I was a freshman or a sophomore in high school. And it
took my year off from college, actually.
Okay, yeah. So it was, I mean, and it just, it was one of those that you heard and thought, I've never heard anything quite like this before. And now here we are so many years down the road, and it's got its detractors and it's got its champions like me. And without getting too much into the entire album, the funny thing about it to me is that it's one of those that has been winnowed down by rock radio and by even the Sirius, which prided itself in the initial offing as being, oh yes, we'll play the stuff you never hear on the radio anymore that you really dig. And they don't, because they suffer from the same thing. They assume that every great band only ever put out three albums and each one of them had one good song on it. And 90125 really suffers from that, because you hear Owner of a Lonely Heart and that's really about it. Where songs like Changes and Leave It get left in the dust. And for my money, I mean, Cranked, absolutely top volume. It's hard to get much better than Leave It.
I can feel no sense of measure, no illusions as we take refuge in young man's pleasure, breaking down the dreams we
It's not a perfect song by any means, but it's one of those that when I really want to hear something loud, that's one of the ones that I gravitate toward. And that's what I wanted to ask about, is just those songs that are left in the dust because there was one hit on the album, or maybe two, that you still go back to all the time. And it almost harkens back to our conversation about Fables of the Reconstruction last week, because that's an album that has a bunch of those songs on it. But one of those that you think is criminally overlooked, because it may have even gotten some notice at the time, but it's been so outshined by the hit off the album that nobody pays attention to it anymore.
Well, let me just start with a couple of things. 90125, I thought was a great album. I'm a Yes fan.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just get that right out of the way. And I've always felt that anybody who knocks that album and claims to be a Yes fan is full of shit. And I say that in absolute seriousness, because, you know, Yes unfortunately did suffer the pains of kind of having revolving lineups.
Yep.
After a couple of albums throughout their whole first phase of their career. Now, people forget the album that came out before 90125 was Drama. That was 1980 or 81. And that was a very odd record, because there was the first album that didn't have John Anderson, a singer.
Okay, yeah.
From the start of their career. It had Trevor Horn and it had Jeff Downs, who at that time were, in fact, the Buggles, and having success as the Buggles.
Yep.
But they had joined Yes. Drama is actually a fairly solid album. It's not a great album by any means, but the whole thing is that Yes had retired the name after that record. It was evident that they were going to go their own ways. Now, I want to go back to Yes as an entity in and of itself, up to 90125. You know, I think Time and a Word is a really good album. I think, well, of course, I think, what do you call it? It is a masterpiece, Fragile.
Yep.
because it gave us Roundabout. I actually like Relayer, and I think a lot of people, you know, are closet Relayer fans because it's only three fucking songs. You know, Gates of Delirium is 24 minutes in one side, and that's all you need to know, you know? I actually really, really, really like Tales from Topographic Oceans.
Yeah.
That magnificent album. That is a magnum opus. So you have to appreciate the different strains and peaks and valleys of Yes as an entity in their different eras. Now, 90125 was a return, and it was, again, a different lineup in that it was the old and the more recent Yes brought together, because you had, you know, Alan White coming back to play drums, Tony Kaye, who had been their original keyboard player, coming back, you know, and instead of, you know, and John Anderson and Chris Squire, of course, God rest his soul, who's still there and always going to be the anchor of Yes. But then you had Trevor Rabin come in to replace, you know, Steve Howe, which were pretty big shoes to fill.
Yep.
And he filled them pretty fucking sweetly.
Yes, he did.
And, you know, the thing is, this was now Yes being a commercially viable band. And there's nothing wrong with that after so many years of being a recording entity.
Right, yeah, because you know? After 15-minute meanderings, they went to four-minute pop songs, and they were great.
You're going to hear fucking Roundabout or Seen All Good People.
Yeah.
You know, Owner of a Lonely Heart is a fucking classic, and it's a fucking great classic for that time. The sound, the feel, the texture, the melody, catchy, which is what a lot of people learn how to do in the – how long was Springsteen out there noodling around without a number one record?
Yeah.
1984.
Yeah.
Okay. 1984 was the year that everybody got to number one. It's that simple. Yes got to number one. Springsteen got to number one. Prince, Madonna, God, even McCartney hit number one.
Yeah.
Number one was for 1984, and that's that. The bottom line is that it's a great album, and people give it short shrift because it was a commercial success. After 15 years of slugging it out, it was well-deserved commercial success. So where is it that age-old argument of, well, they've sold out? After 15 fucking years, they deserve it.
Yeah. Okay? Well, yeah, and you had
an even better video.
Right, and all of the stuff that was there that made them who they were, all of the prog rock, playing with different timings and different, you know, the orchestra hits in Owner of a Lonely Heart, and playing with different ways of approaching harmony and layering harmony in songs like Leave It, that was all still there. They just made pop songs out of it, you know, which is a pretty cool thing to do.
Right, it's called learning how to edit yourself.
Right.
And if you can't edit, then you know, you're in a very problematic spot.
Yep.
You really are.
Right.
You're burying yourself, and you're going to leave yourself to not really have the success that you want and or need.
Right. And can every garage band go out and play Changes? No. How do I know? Try it.
Right. You have to be a skilled musician to be able to do certain things. It's that simple.
Yeah.
And, you know, God bless you if you can do it. Now, to answer the more direct questions, albums of the 80s, definitive albums of the 80s, well, to me, as much as it pains me to say it, I'm going to throw Murmur in there.
Yeah.
Because Murmur is the cornerstone that started the whole thing. Murmur is the album that really was the flashpoint of the birth, in a broader sense, of actually the flower of the American underground coming up and blooming.
Yeah.
You know, because that's where it started. You know, right after Murmur, you did have Emergency Third Reel Power Trip. You had Afoot by Let's Active. You know, later on you had, of course, R.E.M. coming up with Reckoning, Husker Du with Zen Arcade, The Minutemen with Double Nickels on the Dime. You know, this is all within the span of 1 year, but Murmur is where it all came together. It started there because you're looking at Murmur in a time frame, and it came out in April of 1983, and this is right after that horrific week in 1982 in which everyone broke up. Blondie broke up, Squeeze broke up, XTC broke up for a while, The Teardrop Explodes broke up, and The Jam broke up.
Yeah.
So for me, it was really traumatic because I needed something to fit the void. Now, I had already gotten to REM because of Chronic Town, which, by the way, this week saw the 35th anniversary of that album, that EP's release. 35 years since the day that I walked out of the house, said to my mother, I'll be back, I got to go get something in the city, went in and bought that EP and came home with it and just played it to death. Murmur, was, it's also a personal favorite for 1983 because it was the soundtrack album for my high school graduation. I'd like to think that for the people that I went to high school with, including my best friend slash the love of my life, she got into REM because I played that fucking album constantly. I had it on album and cassette. And along with Murmur, though, I'm not going to sit there and keep going on about Murmur. I mean, it's well documented how successful that album truly was, because in a year when Michael Jackson's Thriller was out there, this was the album of the year by Rolling Stone.
Right.
Not Michael Jackson, but the other album of 1983, Synchronicity. Right behind that, I got to give it up. Def Leppard, Pyromania.
Pyromania hit, yeah. And, you know, and you get deeper into the decade. And, well, in fact, not even that much deeper. Purple Rain. And
84.
Right. And then 87 rolls around, and you've got the album that I think outsold everybody else in the 80s, Graceland.
That's true. Was it? No, it was 86. Wasn't Graceland 86?
Could have been. Yeah, it could have been released in late 86. I'd have to look.
Those records, they always get the dealings of the year later. It's when the copyright is on it, because we're talking about the albums of 83, correct?
Yeah.
Or the albums of the 80s.
Just of the 80s in general. But yeah, 83 yeah. Specifically, because it was a hell of a year.
Yeah, so I will go with Murmur, and then I will go with Synchronicity. But, you know, if I was going with the other albums of the 80s, without a doubt, Sound Effects by The Jam. I mean,
yep.
Without Sound Effects, I'm not here.
Right.
It's that simple. You know, Murmur aside, I'm not here without Sound Effects. Other albums of the 80s, Babel by That Petrol Emotion. Rolling Stones album of the year in 1987.
Yep.
Over everybody else. Over Document, which I don't give a shit because I hate that album anyway. it is – I cannot define and emphasize the importance of that record, the impact of it on my life and on my being.
Right.
You know, we will keep going back over and over again. I mean, the two albums that really define the 80s for me on the whole, because The Jam broke up in 82. So now you're going through another 8 years of a decade without that band. REM filled the gap.
Yeah.
83 Murmur, 84 Reckoning, 85 Fables.
Well, right. And all through that entire time period, you know, you've got Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers plugging away. And what do? They end the 80s with Full Moon Fever.
But they start the 80s. Technically, they started the because what do you call it? Damn the Torpedoes was 79.
Yep.
So Hard Promises in 81, which is their that is their best fucking album end to end. Not and plus it's got my favorite song, The Waiting. Which I still do in my acoustic solo, my solo set, because it's just such a good song. That song to me is Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, all you ever need to know right there.
Well, yeah, and it's funny because that brings us around back to the beginning of the conversation, because there's another one that because, and I don't know that this is true, but in my heart, I kind of know that it is. Because the one song that Tom Petty had that got radio airplay like friggin' crazy when it came out and has since just evaporated like he never recorded it was Rebels.
Yeah.
there's not some politics involved in that as well, because that whole, you know, Born a Rebel thing is not as cool as it was maybe when that song came out. But that's a great tune. It really is.
Well, I mean, you know, I obviously can remember when American Girl came out in 76 because I was already 11.
Yep.
And that was kind of like the anthem of the summer on FM radio because, you know, it was the bicentennial year. And it's just a great song anyway. And it was power pop.
Right.
It wasn't like anything else. It wasn't that kind of like, you know, country rock or any of that kind of stuff that was happening at that moment. Refugee.
Yes.
Was everywhere. And I mean everywhere when that came out. I mean that and what was the other one off that off of Damn the Torpedoes? Don't Do Me Like That.
Right.
Those are the two that were just huge staples of – that was at the tail end of my freshman year of high school. And that was at a time when listening to rock radio was a good thing to do because certainly in the New York market on WNEW-FM, Scott Muni had his show Things from England. So he'd play your usual rock fare. You know, you'd hear Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers and you'd hear Cheap Trick, right?
Yeah.
Just, you know, and of course ELO, the stuff that we loved and listened to anyway. But then Things from England would come on at 4 o'clock on Friday afternoons, and all of a sudden he's bringing out things like Reckless Eric, you know, and made me a huge, huge fan.
Yeah.
And he'd play The Jam, and he'd play The Stranglers. You know, he would play some of the weirdest shit that I'd ever heard. And it was all eye-opening and completely a complete revelation. If I'm not mistaken, that was the first place that I ever heard The Teardrop Explodes.
Mm-hmm.
And because this was before WSIA went on the air from, you know, the College of Staten Island. That in and of itself, that was the summer of 81, and that was an accident when I was flipping channels and I heard Stealing People's Mail by the Dead Kennedys coming out of the radio. And I was like, what the fuck?
That's great.
And you're listening to WSIA coming to you from the Middle Earth Lounge of the College of Staten Island. And you just heard the Dead Kennedys with Stealing People's Mail. And I just sat there listening. And the next thing they were playing was like 1 in 10 by UB40 going into Wait for the Blackout by the Damned. That was another song I should have thrown into last week's theme about eclipses. But
right.
Yeah,
right.
You know, and then all of a sudden I hear, you know, the end of the show was Going Underground by The Jam, and I'm flipping out, basically.
Well, you know, I'm not going to let you get out of this because you mentioned the Dead Kennedys without doing your impersonation of Jell-O Biafra, which is just fucking spectacular.
Well, first of all, do you want me to do the talking Jell-O?
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Jell-O kind of does that. I'm doing Exaggerated Biafra, you know, unless you want me to do, so you've been to school for a year or two and you know you've said it all. That's Biafra, as we all know. And low, but, you know, well, you know, we got, what is that spiel he does? Yeah. Have a little bit more MSG, some more pretzels, the tricky dicky screwdriver.
Oh.
For Ronald Reagan, born again with fascist cravings. Still, you made me president.
That just makes me smile. Well, Rob Ross, we're going to put the rap on it from there. And
he's going to hear this. He's going to come after me, that motherfucker.
That's all right.
But I know he buys used underwear at the Salvation Army, so he better shut up.
There you go. We'll talk more next time around on Radio City. Thanks to everybody for listening. We'll have more for you next week.